Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. I'm not sure this has ever been possible before in the annals of radio history. This morning, on this radio show, we will feature two different books focused on the history of Franklin County, Vermont. Wild, right? So much love for the FC. At 10, we're going to speak with Jason Barney about his book, Hidden History of Franklin County, Vermont. But we start by hearing about my favorite U.S. president. Yes, the famous number 21, born in East Fairfield, Chester A. Arthur. So great was this man, or maybe intriguing is the better word to describe him, that Harry Goldhagen has completed a comic book about his life and exploits. It's hot off the presses and called Searching for Chester Arthur. And Harry's here to tell us all about what he's learned about Chet. Harry, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thanks, Rick. It's a pleasure to be on again.
Great to have you back. Listeners, to ask Harry about Chester A. Arthur or about his comic book or to share a fact about Chet, you can give us a call, 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Harry, what was your first meeting with Chester A. Arthur?
Yes, I document that in the comic book.
You do.
I was eating at a Howard Johnson's restaurant. I'm not even sure they exist anymore. And the placemat had a picture of him along with all the other presidents. And I was just fascinated by his mutton chops.
Ah, the mutton chops. Yeah, it is the thing that attracts those few of us who are attracted to Chet. The mutton chops, probably the last president ever to have mutton chops. I don't think anyone will be elected with them, alas. So when you saw this and you saw this guy, Chester A. Arthur, were you so moved that you, the next time you had to do a report at school, you wrote about Chester A. Arthur?
Actually, I didn't think about him again for 20 years, maybe longer.
Do you remember? Okay. Do you remember what you had at the Hojo's that day?
I'm guessing pancakes.
All right. Sounds good. Not the fried clams. Now, in the comic book, you mention Carl Anthony. Who was Carl Anthony?
Well, he's I didn't really know him in high school. He was a year behind me, but he would get on stage for our annual plays and recite all the presidents and vice presidents and secretaries of state in order. And so they always made a role for him so he could do this each year. What I didn't know during high school was that he was trying to save Chester Arthur's house in Manhattan. And he was encouraged by Jackie Kennedy, it blows my mind even today to realize here he was, a high school kid communicating with presidents and presidential families as much as he could. And he tried to save Chet Arthur's house, his brownstone in Manhattan.
Whatever happened to Carl Anthony?
Well, he became a world-famous historian focusing on presidential wives mostly, but about the Kennedy administration as well. He's got I don't know how many books out now, and he was kind enough to share his story with me.
Oh, that's fantastic. All right, so your first meeting with Chester A. Arthur was in Howard Johnson's. What was your second meeting with Chester A. Arthur?
Yes, it was Die Hard with a Vengeance, the third movie in that action series. The truck driver in the tunnel actually knew who Chester Arthur was because Bruce Willis was looking for 21. Who's 21? What does 21 mean? Could it be the president? And so this blue-collar truck driver says, sure, that's Chet Arthur.
And still at that point, it didn't kick in. You thought, oh, Chester A. Arthur, right, I remember him from Hojo's. I'm going to write about him. I'm going to do some digging. It just blew by you.
Yeah, again, I didn't really pay much attention. It's just a momentary, well, that's amusing.
All right. So at some point in your life, you're brought to Vermont. I want to know what brought you to Vermont and to the birthplace of Chester A. Arthur.
Well, I had moved from New York City to Utah, of all places. New York was pretty bad when I moved. Mm-hmm. Crime rate was pretty high, and I was really sick of commuting to Manhattan from Queens. And so some friends were moving to Utah, and I said, you know, it's a good time to move, and my job was going to let me telecommute. So I lived in the Salt Lake Valley for about 12 years, but a little-known fact that Salt Lake Valley gets as polluted as L.A. when the weather conditions are right. And
wow.
You get this huge layer, what they call the inversion. But it's just smog that gets trapped there for months at a time during the winter. So I had to get out eventually. And by accident, I ended up in Fairfield, Vermont. There was a house available. The first house fell through, the one in Charlotte. And so I just by accident ended up here in Fairfield.
It was fate, your third meeting with Chester A. Arthur. How big a deal is Chet in Fairfield, Vermont?
Everywhere you look. Actually, just last night I was driving from the Colt Hollow Sculpture Park to the Flack Family Farm, where they had the Raw Milk Theater performed last night, a local talent show. And, of course, I took Chester Arthur Road.
Of course.
Through Fairfield, and that got me there to Pumpkin Village Road via Duffy Hill, if you really know Fairfield. So everywhere you look, there's something Chester Arthur here. There's Chester's Bakery. There's, of course, the Chester Arthur Birthplace and Chester Arthur Road. It's there's housing for seniors here called what is it? I think it's just called Chester Arthur Housing.
And isn't there a didn't someone create a kind of cutout statue of of Chet
that
moves
of those
around?
Cardboard thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's still sitting. He's a little worse for wear after I borrowed him, but he's about 6 feet tall, and he sits in the town office. And people who actually search out presidential birthplaces and find their way to Fairfield often pose with the cutout and, you know, and have their picture taken by the town clerk.
All right. So, Harry, you know, you swung and missed on the first attempt, you know, when Chet presented himself. You swung and missed on the second attempt, but you're not going to get struck out. What finally inspired you, once you moved to Fairfield, to write about Chester A. Arthur?
Well, the project, it began in my mind pretty soon after I moved to Fairfield because of all the signs and everything about him. And I said, I'm going to do a documentary about him one day. But other projects took over. And but then Scott Greenberger, who's a journalist and author, came to town. And he had just finished a biography, a new biography of Chester Arthur, bringing the total number of books, I think, about the 21st president to 9. Something like that. I think six biographies, something like that. So when I happened to be driving by the library when I remembered he was giving his talk, and I had my camera with me, my video camera. So I just set up and filmed his talk, and I became smitten.
Yeah, and it's a great book. Is it The Unexpected President?
Yes.
And he did a really great job of, the life of Chester A. Arthur. And so you finally decided to write about him, not do a documentary, but of all things, why a comic book about Chester A. Arthur?
Well, there were a few things. One is the documentary was going pretty slowly. I had some footage, some interviews on Church Street and other things. I went around Fairfield and actually a fair amount of Vermont with the cutout, filming him in various places. But then there was some family illness, and then, of course, the pandemic struck, and so forget about doing any kind of documentary. So it was, I guess it was about February, I said, I have all these photographs, I have video I could save single images from. It's dark outside, I'm not going anywhere anyway, why don't I make a comic book out of it? I had seen... There was another element to that. There was a Professor Vivanco from UVM who came up to the Cold Hollow Sculpture Park and gave a talk about making comic books about history. And it's a great way of communicating. So I applied it, and I said, how long could this take? I'll have this done in 3 weeks.
Famous last words. And one morning I was talking about, I was looking for someone to come on the show and talk about Chester A. Arthur. Anyone who's done, you know, who knows the history of him or his biography. And Harry Goldhagen stepped up, and we chatted. The book was in the works. Now it is published. Vermont's Chester A. Arthur had overcome a birther movement of his own to be elected as the country's vice president, the only elected office that he ever ran for. His running mate, James A. Garfield, once taught penmanship in a Pownall, Vermont school, a position held previously by Chester A. Arthur. Mark Twain once said, "It would be hard indeed to better President Arthur's administration." Harry Goldhagen became captivated with Arthur at a Hojo's and now has a published comic book about the 21st U.S. president, and that proves his love for this man. Harry's with us for a few more minutes to hop in with Chet Facts. You can call us at 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. Let's talk a little bit, Harry, about Chester A. Arthur's career, first as a lawyer, and the case that really kind of put him to the front, the Elizabeth Jennings case.
Oh yes, that was really groundbreaking. Surprisingly, he didn't talk much about it during his life, but he helped defend a black American school teacher who was thrown off a trolley because it was a whites-only trolley, even though supposedly, well, slavery was certainly banned in New York City, but segregation wasn't, and he defended her, and she won. And it began, it led to the desegregation of at least trolley cars in New York. It took longer for some other things, and he was quite the hero about this.
Yeah. And then the Civil War came. What did Chet do during the Civil War?
Oh, he had the best job of all. He was the he dealt with all the supplies. He was the the quartermaster general of New York. So he basically got all the clothing, the guns, anything the army needed. He was the supply sergeant, basically.
He made some great connections, and this eventually led to a position that was really powerful and could earn him a lot of money in New York City.
Oh, indeed. He was the head of the Custom House, which was where all the money, or everything that flowed into America pretty much came through the New York Custom House. And everybody had to pay fees, and I think we could safely call it bribes. and the salary was enormous, plus all the tips and all the money that just poured through. The guy became loaded.
Yeah, and I think if you seized anything illegal, you got a certain cut of that as well. So he was lining his pockets, and they were great pockets. The man, like I said, owned 80 pairs of pants. He was a very dandy dresser. Now let's go to the 1880 GOP National Convention. What happened there?
Oh, well, the two candidates who were in the running, U.S. Grant, who was wanted to run for a third term, and Blaine, J.M. Blaine, were neck and neck, and neither had enough votes at the at the Republican convention. So they had 35
yep.
ballots, and this was summer in Chicago, and it was steaming hot. And people were getting sick of it. And finally, Garfield's name was thrown in. He had given an opening talk. Actually, it was for one of the other runners. He gave the introduction, but they started voting for Garfield, and he ended up winning.
And Arthur was put on as a kind of a compromise for vice president. So you had James A. Garfield, who was not running for president. Chester A. Arthur, who never ran for anything before in his life, couldn't be a more perfect ticket, right?
They somehow managed to win. I guess the magic of Lincoln's party helped get them through, and who knows, maybe a little shenanigans in the voting booths as well. But actually, I don't think this one was as crooked as some of the earlier ones.
Well, then not long into his term as president, James A. Garfield shot and lingered on for a while.
Oh, boy, the medical care in those days was pretty dreadful. The doctors kept sticking their fingers into Garfield's wounds. He probably would have survived if they had just let it heal.
Mm-hmm.
But they couldn't remove the bullet, and they kept poking at him and bleeding him and all sorts of other awful treatments of the time. So Garfield perished, and Chester Arthur, though he probably didn't want it, became president.
Yeah, very unexpected and very hesitant to become president of the United States, but there he was, kind of pushed into this position. And one of the things that was very interesting was now one of the reasons they put him in the position was they thought, as with him as vice president, he'd be handing out patronage jobs out the back door of the White House. But then something happened, civil reform, the Pendleton Act. Explain that.
Well, in at that time, any job in the civil service was an appointment, so that if you did right by a politician, donated money, or otherwise served your party, then you would get a job. And there was a lot of reform-minded people in the country at the time trying to put a stop to it. And for some reason, Chester Arthur decided to take the reform direction, even though it seemed contrary to all he had done in the 20 years before.
Now, the other thing, he shows up at the White House. It was in rather poor condition, and he loved the finer things in life. So what did he do for the White House itself?
Wow, he gutted the place. He threw out all the old horsehair furniture, and he got Louis Tiffany and other leading decorators to just redo the whole place. It was beautiful.
Made it into an absolute show place that we are proud of to this day. So Chet does a lot of great things as president. I mentioned he converted the Navy, which was woeful, from wooden ships to steel ships, made him a power on the high seas. Along comes the 1884 GOP National Convention. So what happens with Chet?
Nobody wants him. The more patronage-minded parts of the party felt betrayed, so they didn't want to support him at the convention. And the reform-minded people still distrusted him, and they didn't want him. So a sitting president wasn't nominated for the next election.
And he didn't fight too hard, though, to get the nomination.
No, he was pretty sick by then. He had Bright's disease, which we now call kidney disease, nephritis. And there wasn't really much treatment for it then, so he was very ill. And so I don't think he minded just going back to his law career and pretty much retiring.
And then he passed away, I think, shortly thereafter, after leaving the White House. So he probably wouldn't have fulfilled his term if he had gotten the nomination. As you mentioned, very few books about this guy. So yours is number 10, is that correct?
I suppose so. Oh, dear, to think. Let's see, there are four biographies I found,
mm-hmm.
two novels, which I wrote, he was a minor but important character, and one rather cheesy and probable thriller.
Which one is that?
That is the Chester A. Arthur Conspiracy.
Oh, I can't wait to read it.
It was our local library, the Bent Northrop Memorial Library here in Fairfield, has an annual book sale, books that have been are not getting much readership anymore, and that was one of them. And I said, Chester, author, I've got to pick up this book and see what the conspiracy was. And, oh, it was dreadful. I read pretty much every book I pick up from start to finish, and this one I had to put down.
What happened when you took the cutout of Chester A. Arthur and had someone interview people and ask, who is this man?
Oh, that was so much fun. I got my friend Cynthia Brerin, who's a singer in Burlington and throughout Vermont, and she acted in both my movies. So I said, would you act like a reporter for me? And she just went with the job. She dressed like it. She had a handheld microphone, and we put the cutout next to her, and she would just call people over and say, you, hey, you over there, do you know who this man is? And people would come by, and I had the camera rolling. I was recording her audio and from the microphone. And we got the funniest answers. I'd say two-thirds of the people didn't know who he was. A lot were able to guess that he was a president. Mm-hmm. I guess the mutton chops. Or actually, there was one fellow with a really incredible beard and mustache. He could have passed for a Chet Arthur lookalike. And, he actually knew who Chet Arthur was. But we got some very funny answers.
I think 28% of the people you interviewed actually knew who he was, which that's actually pretty good, I think. All right. There is, and we only have about a minute left, but there's an actual connection or a couple between Chester A. Arthur and President Barack Obama.
Now, that was funny. While I was doing this, I was chatting with my friend Sharon Evans, who lives in Bakersfield. She was the music teacher there. And her sister had done one of those tracing back the family, I don't know, seven generations, eight generations. So she found out that she was related to both Chester Arthur and Barack Obama. I think, let's see, for Chester Arthur, she was sixth cousin thrice removed, and about the same for Barack Obama. So that means they are both very distantly related.
And the other connection?
Well, they were both were treated with birther movements.
That's right. A lot of people believed or spread the story that Chester A. Arthur was actually born in Quebec and was Canadian. Some then said he was actually born in Ireland, but neither was proven. We claim him here in East Fairfield. Harry Goldhagen's latest book is called Searching for Chester Arthur. You can pick up a copy at his website, harrylama.com. Harry, I want to thank you for spreading the word of this well-dressed, mutton-chopped commander-in-chief.
Thanks so much, Rick. It's always a pleasure.
Always a pleasure. We're going to take a break and then come back to hear about something billed as Not Your Average Climate Conference. And a reminder that today at 1, it's Travels with Charlie with host Charlie Papillo, followed by 2 hours of The Getaway with our very own Greg Hooker. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. What would bring together professional surfers, corporate CEOs, company directors of impact and social change, and a few Vermonters? It's an international online event called Sea Change on Water. For 2 days, dozens of speakers will be discussing climate action and sustainable entrepreneurship and the Vermont Connection, the producers of the conference. And one of them joins us right now. That's Alex Lally. He's the director of Signal Kitchen. And Alex, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thanks, Rick. Thanks for having me. Good to chat with you.
Good to chat with you. We're hoping to hear from Russ Scully as well, another of the co-founder of Sea Change Sessions. Listeners, if you've got a question about the Sea Change Sessions, or if you're participating in one, you can call us at 244-1777 or toll free 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. And I should, because you are only hearing this, the word sea change is S-E-E, as in seeing change, just so everyone's aware of that. So, Alex, what are the sea change sessions?
That's a good question, big one. The sea change sessions came together late 2019. And the intent around it was to bring together leaders in the outdoor recreation space that are interested in sustainability, to bring them together to put them in immersive environments outdoors, and then bring them back to the hula space, which I'll explain in a minute, for more of conference-type fare, so master classes and workshops and the like. So the really unique part of the model that we had come up with early on was the first part of the day was bringing these leaders of this space together to go on these adventures around the state of Vermont. So backcountry riding with a Burton Pro or ice climbing with a tech founder, unique ways for people to connect with each other that are atypical and outside of the normal conference experience. So that had all been designed and thought through pre-pandemic. And when the pandemic hit, we had to determine whether or not we were going to stick to our guns and roll it out or wait. And we decided to roll it out completely virtually. So in kind of a very cool way, it ended up creating a whole new arm of Sea Change, which again was initially just people coming to Vermont, about 500 leaders to be together. It opened us up to this kind of global model where our first Sea Change happened in March. And Yvonne Choudenard from Patagonia was there, and, you know, CEOs from France were there, and people from all around the world that would have been much harder to capture or bring to Vermont were there. So it is now this, like, hybrid model where there's a big virtual event happening and also a small, pretty concentrated group of 200-300 people coming to Vermont to be together to learn about ways to make their business more sustainable.
Oh, that's fantastic. You mentioned hula. Russ Scully is the founder of hula. What is hula?
Good. Yeah, I'll give it a shot, and then he can give it an even better one.
But all right, Russ, thanks.
Hula is a co-working, just an incredible co-working and accelerator space on a 14-acre campus in Burlington on the lake. And it was the old Blodgett Oven manufacturing building. So they were originally these really cool, awesome old industrial manufacturing buildings that have been completely gutted and redone and designed with like human connection and development in mind. It don't do it justice describing it. You got to get people to come and see it. Another really unique part of the campus is there's a beach. The Burlington Surf Club is on the campus. So that when I talked to you earlier about Sea Change and how it's this combination of conference and outdoor adventures, the Sea Change Sessions that's happening in August will utilize that space. So we'll be doing e-foiling adventures and stand-up paddleboard sessions with a pro surfer in the morning, and then you'll come back to Hula in its event space to do the conference. There's another arm of Hula that is a impact investment venture capital fund that is investing specifically in Vermont businesses. And there's just an incredible ecosystem of new tech companies and just awesome brands in that Hula space now that are doing really interesting things in green tech and energy tech. And I'm sure you've heard of Beta Technologies. This is like electric aviation. Yep. And just great companies there that, you know, I, for one, before I was introduced to this crew and this whole Hula world, I didn't know this stuff was happening in Vermont. And then there would be one thing after the other that just kind of blew me away. So,
well, Alex, tell people about your operation. Tell people what Signal Kitchen is.
Yeah, Signal Kitchen has been around since about 2011. And the initial kind of version of Signal Kitchen, and I think I've chatted with you about it way back in the day, it was a 250 capacity music venue in downtown Burlington. And so that was one part of the business. The second part was a multimedia production facility. So we were bringing national and local acts to Vermont, and then making content with them while and after they performed shows for the public. So we would have ticketed shows and be making these videos and then pushing the videos out to a more global audience. That was the original version of the company. It evolved into becoming an agency where we produce larger scale events and content for clients and with clients. So SeaChange is an example of us working with, in this case, a partner, Hula, to develop a concept for an event from the ground up and then produce it and execute it and keep on doing it.
And this new SeaChange Summit, which is next week, is SeaChange on Water. So explain, you know, what the focus will be during that summit.
Yeah, so it's a seasonal model. We do it once in the winter, and that's SeaChange on Snow. That happened this past winter in March, and it will happen in 2022 in February. Summer one is SeaChange on Water. So a lot of the topics and a lot of the minds at the table are things about how we best protect water from an entrepreneurial lens. So these are tech leaders and you know, people from great brands like Patagonia and Ben & Jerry's, but all generally talking about topics that have to do with protecting water, using water more efficiently, et cetera. And then snow is the same, only with snow being the topic.
All right. And what will happen during the 2 days of the summit?
Yeah, so there are a handful of different kind of types of things to experience. So primarily what we're talking about right now is the virtual event. There are a handful of different types of content that happen. There are, you know, more typical things like keynotes and presentations. But what's really interesting is these, they're called labs and workshops. These are like very interactive spaces that this is one of the things that the virtual pivot for us really cracked open, because the platform we're using to produce this event on, it's called Hopin. It was designed for interaction. So when you think about a keynote, you think about a keynote speaker presenting to an audience. But the way that we're designing a lot of the sessions at SeaChange virtually are two ways. So there can be the CEO of Patagonia there, and there can be a great new startup or nonprofit leader from wherever in the same room engaging with each other in conversation, which, you know, that was the thing that virtual kind of blew the doors off of. And it's brand new and we're still trying to pin it down, but it became less of a one to many and now just these interactive sessions. So I think that's what you should think about when you think about SeaChange. That's different than a lot of kind of typical conference environments, that you actually get to be in the room with these leaders. You get to ask them questions. You get to engage with them. And that was one of the benefits coming out of COVID and virtual that we found.
SeaChange on Water is next Wednesday and Thursday, August 18th and 19th. And Alex, how does somebody participate in it?
You can go to seachangesessions.com. There are various pass types. We start with student passes that are way discounted, because part of the vision here is creating this really diverse group of humans that are communicating about this. There's great conferences that are focused on sustainability directors. There's great conferences that are focused on founders. But what we really imagine is a student, a CEO, an artist in the same room trying to solve the problem. So we start at a $25 ticket for students, and then we go up to all access passes that come along with a lot of other things. So if you just go to seachangesessions.com and you check out the ticket page, you can learn more about that. You can check out the program page and learn all about what speakers are coming, what sessions we've got, and the rest of the agenda.
And that's seachangesessions.com. Alex, give us some idea of the people who will be speaking during the summit next week.
Yeah, totally. It's like I said a little bit earlier, very, very diverse group of people. There's a gentleman named Tony Fadell. Tony Fadell invented the iPod, co-invented the iPhone with Steve Jobs, and is also now a very kind of focused impact investor. So he's got a company called Future Shape that is investing in all kinds of interesting new technology that is sustainable and kind of forward-thinking with the earth in mind. Laird Hamilton is a great, really interesting big wave pro surfer. He also started a company called Laird Superfoods. So he and his wife, Gabrielle Reese, are coming to chat about the kind of parallels between the mind of an athlete and the mind of an entrepreneur, and then also give a little bit of background on the founding of their company, Laird Superfoods. A Vermonter, as of now, a guy named Captain Paul Watson, who was one of the co-founders of Greenpeace, also the founder of Sea Shepherd, who's just like a really cool, interesting activist, has been running around the world saving whales forever. He's there in conversation with a gentleman named Cyril Gooch, who is the founder of a company called Parlay for the Oceans. Parlay for the Oceans is our beneficiary, so Sea Change is a fundraiser. And Parlay for the Oceans is just a really interesting company that's doing incredible stuff with ocean plastic. So they're basically gathering up tons of ocean plastic and turning it into consumer goods. And they have a partnership with Adidas, and you can get those shoes and that gear right now that is all made out of ocean plastic in partnership with Parlay.
Mm.
Kate Williams, CEO of 1% for the Planet. They are also in the Hula building. They 1% has been an instrumental part of this event from kind of concept through the first Sea Change we did in March. She is doing a really interesting masterclass, and 1% in general is all over it. And B Labs, which is another certification organization, they are also a partner, so they have a bunch of interesting speakers coming and covering a handful of topics. We've got all in all about 80 speakers.
Wow.
So I won't.
No, but that is a great start. Gives people a good taste of who will be there, and the types of people who will be there, the level of speakers that you have. Explain this intersection of concern for the environment, companies, and outdoor sports. It almost seems like three disparate things.
There's a Jacques Cousteau quote, and it's, we always protect what we love. And that is, I mean, the quote came to us later, but we realized that is actually what we were trying to do here.
Hmm.
The idea was to get people who are passionate about the outdoors. And some of these people are in the outdoor recreation market. They're Burton, Patagonia, other people. Some of them are not, but they have a passion for the outdoors. And the idea for this summit was to immerse them in those environments and around those people, to not only give them like tactical information about how to do their business better, but also just to inspire them, to remind them of, this is the thing that we need to protect and we love this thing. So in a sense, it's for the outdoor recreation market and a lot of those companies, but in a broader sense, it's for any entrepreneur that's interested in sustainability and is passionate about the outdoors and is somebody who gets out there and is in it. And it doesn't mean you have to be a professional snowboarder. You could like to hike. It's all different levels. It's just someone who's passionate about it. And does that help with the intersection? I know
it does.
It's confusing, but that's the niche we're in.
Yeah, and it takes somebody to just tie it together like you just did, which I appreciate. You mentioned this kind of early on, told us a little bit about this, the thing called the Startup Classic, which is part of the summit.
Yeah, so the Startup Classic, we introduced that just for this upcoming summer event. We didn't have it in the winter, and it's something we'll develop and continue to keep in the mix for Sea Change sessions. But it's essentially a startup pitch competition. You as a startup need to be focused in ESG, sustainable business. You need to be on that path, and your business needs to represent that. And we are selecting out of all of our applicants four companies that can pitch, and they're pitching to a board of five really interesting impact investors from around the world. So there's a group from Hawaii called Elemental Accelerator. There's a representative from Hula, because as I mentioned earlier, they also have a venture capital fund and a handful of others. So that's a new experiment wouldn't do it justice, but we're introducing it this time around. Everybody's locked up. It's a really great group of four companies that'll be pitching to these venture capitalists.
Can people still apply for that, or has that been already chosen, the four that will be pitching?
That's already been chosen, but what we hope to do beyond just being selected is that we have a track at the conference that's called impact investment. So beyond these pitch beyond the pitch competition, there's another five or six sessions that focus just on impact investment. So we hope that other startups that may not have been selected or may not have gotten to the chance to apply mm-hmm. can still dive in and learn about the process, learn about why impact investors pick what they pick, and see how others actually present their work. So you know, the opportunity shouldn't be limited just to folks who got selected. That's the hope.
Excellent. And Alex, what do you hope people will come away from this summit with?
Yeah. So like those two lanes I said earlier, one is inspiration. And that's, you know, part of our focus when we program this, is that focus on bringing diverse minds. You know, from the beginning, one of the thoughts was we need to have a bunch of pro athletes here who can talk about their relationship with the outdoors. And some of these stories are just so vivid and incredibly inspiring. So that's the first stop, is we want people to leave here feeling inspired and rejuvenated and ready to go protect the earth. Second is like just tactical, useful, real time information. So, you know, one track we have is called innovative materials. And we know a lot of companies are trying to find ways to innovate with their materials. Like we're talking about, you know, replacing plastic with mushrooms. We're talking about mm-hmm. circular economy with plastic. So giving people like real stuff, not dreamy stuff, but more like this is possible. And if you want to research it, you can get in touch with this company and they're doing this. We want them to leave with action items that they can actually move on. So two pretty different goals, but those are our North Stars when we're programming.
And we only have about 30 seconds left, but if someone can't watch live next Wednesday and Thursday, will they still be able to access the summit?
Yeah, you can sign up for our newsletter, and we'll release a portion of the content post-event. And then moving forward, this is going to happen twice a year. We're already working on February 2022 winter and summer. So just keep in the loop. We're growing and moving forward, and there will be a lot to hear from us.
All right. Alex Lally is the director of Signal Kitchen. You can learn more about the event at SEE, SeeChangeSessions.com. Alex, thanks so much for letting us know about the summit.
Yeah, thank you, Rich, for the opportunity. Rich.
Yeah, that's okay.
Have a good day.
All right, take care. All right, time to pop out for news. Then we'll be hearing about the hidden history of Franklin County. All right, the Sox have the night off as they head back to Boston to open up a series tomorrow against the division-leading Tampa Bay Rays. That means a full hour and a half of the Brady Farkas Show tonight, followed by Dinner Jazz with Jazzy John Wilson. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I like to call the area in which it's situated the Great Northwest Kingdom. Alas, so far the GNK has not caught on with anyone, but maybe it will after today, as we are about to hear about our second book today focused on Franklin County, Vermont. Earlier we spoke with Harry Goldhagen about his new comic book about President Chester A. Arthur, born in East Fairfield. Now we get a broader history lesson from author and historian Jason Barney. Jason's new book is called Hidden History of Franklin County, Vermont. He joins us now to share some of the stories that he's uncovered and included in the book. Jason, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. Listeners, to ask Jason about Franklin County history or share some of your own, you can give us a call at 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Jason, what does the term hidden history mean to you?
Oh, I think it's pretty subjective. The History Press, the publisher that I'm working with right now, mm-hmm. A lot of their hidden history material in the past has been stuff that dealt with either ghost stories or stories about a place in the woods, et cetera. But with my being a public school teacher and because of the classes that I teach, I wanted to take the opportunity to just expose a little bit of Franklin County history that my generation, I'm 46 years old, but I grew up in Franklin County, and the generations that I have taught at MVU, I wanted to give them an opportunity to see history that is in the newspapers and in family stories, but maybe isn't talked about too much or hasn't been covered. So for me, Hidden History was a chance to talk about things which are locally known but haven't gotten a heck of a lot of exposure. And then the other part of that was, and this is maybe even a bigger piece or a bigger answer to that question, a lot of stuff in the book covers material that is directly connected to larger events. Mm-hmm. So whether or not it's Native occupation or the Revolutionary War or the Cold War, one of the things I like to do as a teacher and as a writer is to try to make connections about things that happen local or happened local to larger events that are covered in the history books. So on that level, it's a real joy to expose those things, because I know up here in Franklin County, and I think in a lot of places in Vermont, sometimes people feel that they are raised or that they live in an area that is not the center of the universe.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really, really nice to make those connections and connect those dots and tell history about things that are in textbooks, but to make the local connections.
How do you go about digging up Franklin County's hidden history?
So, probably the most fun part of the research was an Ancestry.com membership, and through that you also have access to a lot of old newspapers, newspapers.com. So when doing the research, and this is something that we do on and off with our students too, a lot of the old newspapers have been digitized. So when they're digitized, that gives people an opportunity to go online and not search like last week's newspaper or newspapers from last year. It gives you the chance to take a look at newspapers going all the way back to 1812, all the way back to some of the earliest print. I can imagine how painstaking that process is, because somebody has to take a very good quality cover photo, mm-hmm. and all of those pages need to be put online. So for me, in particular, with the stuff that had to do with the Cold War and some of the stuff about movie history up here, I went through the old St. Albans Messengers, and there's another local paper up here. It still exists. It's the County Courier, but at the time it was called the Swanton Courier, and they had a treasure trove of really, really specific details relating to local history and facts, and it was just fun typing in a particular search term and waiting for the results and trying to tell a story through it.
I love it. And you also give a special nod to the historical societies throughout Franklin County in the book at the very end, which I loved. What would you say is the most telling characteristic of the history of Franklin County?
Long-term habitation. It's a specific vein as a way to answer that question. And unfortunately, it's only one chapter in my book, but there are several other chapters that have been written about this. This area of northwest Vermont and a lot of areas of New England, they have been inhabited for a very, very long time.
Mm-hmm.
With the groups that will eventually become the Abnaki to, 9 or 10,000 years ago as the ice sheets are sort of retreating north into Canada, it's just neat and crazy to think that people were standing in the places that we are right now thousands of years ago. And this has been a place that people saw as a good location to raise families and live and get their food for a long, long time. So, and for me, the specific hidden history part of it for my students and as a teacher is to make the point to my students that yes, they are raised in an area with a low population, but this area has a history that is long and something to be proud of.
Yeah, and the book does start off with the chapter about the Abenaki and the Native American presence in Franklin County, which I love. What efforts are being made to learn more about that history and to preserve it?
Well, I can only speak to my efforts as an individual teacher, but I've been teaching at MVU for 19 years. Mm-hmm. When I started off teaching, I was probably the typical social studies teacher, teaching economics and U.S. history. And then there was a class that was taught by another gentleman in the department, basically Native American history. And we ended up changing some of our class requirements based on the state social studies standards. And that class got reorganized, and I was the teacher that asked to take on that class. And a lot of it has to do with sort of individual initiative as a teacher. I wanted to make sure that I was doing well for the Abenaki community or for the Iroquois or Mohawks in upstate New York or any of the native tribes that exist throughout New England. So I just started to do a lot of individual research. And my research for the Abenaki material hasn't focused in on stuff from the time when since whites have been in the area, but a lot of the archaeological evidence. So up here in Swanton, probably to the great headache to certain members in the Abenaki community, there have been several burial grounds that have been discovered on Monument Road in Swanton and Highgate. But throughout the area, and I'm sure down in your neck of the woods too, there are archaeological sites. So there are a couple of books that have been written about that. And I wouldn't read those necessarily for pleasure, although it was very fun getting into that level of research. But I would read them and take notes, and every single time there was something about an archaeological site that was something that I could cover with my students, I immediately wrote it down and tried to develop PowerPoints on it and develop lessons on it. So some of the specific things, there's archaeological evidence of something called a hunting tool called an atlatl. And that's something that we've had some students build up here at MPU. It's basically a throwing instrument. If you think of a pitcher throwing a baseball, it adds another wrist or another elbow motion to the throw, and it allows a thrower to throw the spear or dart quite a bit further. And that would help take down a moose or a bear or a deer. And we've had students build those. Recently, the members of the Abenaki community have done some sort of ethnobotany research, and they think that they've positively identified specific strains of corn, beans, and squash that were raised up here in New England. So I've gotten my hands on those. At one point in time, we tried to do a little bit of a garden up here on MVU soil. That didn't work particularly well because the growing season is during the summer, and I have my own garden at the house. But I grew some of those crops at the house, and I'll bring in the squash, and I'll bring in the corn and the beans, and the students will see them, and it's a very hands-on experience for them. And in some cases, they get into it, like they want to know the specific names of the beans, and in other cases, it's just something that, because this is an agriculture community, it's something that the students can make connections to.
And we should mention, you were honored by the Vermont Humanities Council. Tell us about that award.
Yeah, so it was something that wasn't expected. I'd been teaching for 16 or 17 years, and I had had my local history class at the school for maybe 3 or 4 years at that point. And I was just getting really into my research, not just about Native Americans, but the Revolutionary War and the War of 1812. And that was probably about the time when my first book was published. But two former teachers, they're now, one of them's still teaching at the school and another one's moved into administration. They didn't tell me about it, but they filled out basically some paperwork, which put my name in the pool of people who could receive this award. And I came to school, was teaching for a couple of weeks, and they showed up at my door, and they kind of looked proud and nervous. And I was like, so am I supposed to be hanging something in the halls? Because I'm quite a bit taller than them. And they said, nope, we have some good news. It's something we didn't tell you about. And they let me know that I had won this award. And it was a great honor. And it became even more of an honor when I found out that the guy down in Rutland, or at Rutland High School, who just retired, John Peterson, he had been my cooperating teacher when I did my student teaching down at the College of St. Joseph. He had won that award maybe 20 years ago. So he was a teacher who was just phenomenal. I would say that I'm pretty good as far as energy in the classroom, but John was excellent. So it was an honor to know that I held my cooperating teacher in such high esteem, but colleagues of mine were willing to put my name into something that was pretty big.
Wow. Well done, Jason. Congratulations. Jason, I'll let you choose a subject from your book to really get us started. Was there one subject that you really loved researching and learning about for the book?
Yeah. Before we do that, I just want to mention a couple of things.
Sure.
And I think sometimes I need to be better about doing something like this, because
okay.
The project is certainly my work, but I want to thank the administration at NBU, Jay Hartman and Dan Palmer and Jen Disorder. I teach the local history, and so much of the material that the local history class at the school, so much of the material that is in the book is in some way connected to some of the research that I do with my students.
Mm-hmm.
I also want to mention, and you had mentioned this earlier in the intro to the book, that there are some images from the local historical societies up here that
yes.
make the book. And that's something that I do with my students too, where I'll spend time trying to find like the perfect image to give them an idea of what the history was. So I do want to thank Lindsay Didio, Ashley Bowen, Josh Sins, and Armin Messier for providing some of the artwork for the book. And then Diane Mock, she's also a former MBU teacher. And specifically to answer your question, what part of the book did I enjoy researching the most? So I should also communicate to your listeners that as a writer, there are successes and failures. And the Hidden History of Franklin County, while I love the book and I love the research that I put into it and thank the History Press for the opportunity to write it, I had originally put together another pitch about the communes and the counterculture era in the 1960s and 1970s mm-hmm. up here in Franklin County. And there was one individual, Larry Mead, who provided a lot of the photos from that era. And just to go off on a little bit of a specific rabbit hole here, but a lot of those members who were in some of the communes or some of the sort of counterculture colonies, they are still around. Some of them live in Vermont. Some of them live in different parts of the country. But they are getting older, and they do have health concerns, et cetera. And as I was starting out on that research to make the pitch for that book, I can remember calling a guy who now lives out in California or lived out in California, Charlie Pratt. And he was the first one who I was able to do an interview with. And he let me know that his health was not good, and he conducted one interview, and then his health deteriorated, and then he passed away. So it's kind of an example of material that ends up in the book that is important because, you know, we all live under a certain timeline, and I'm doing a little bit of research, and he was just gracious enough to give an interview and talk about his experiences. But as somebody who was raised in Franklin County and somebody who has taught here, I definitely had Vietnam War era guest speakers, men and particularly men who had served in Vietnam and would come into my U.S. history classes and tell about their experiences, either fighting the North Vietnamese Army or being in the jungles or being deployed or being drafted. And I think my students definitely enjoyed that. But the older I got and the more I did local history research, I came to learn that there was a commune that was right up here in the town of Franklin. And then through that research, I learned that there were several other sort of counterculture type colonies in Franklin County and then definitely throughout the state of Vermont. And people who are older than me probably remember some of that history. But for me, it was an honor. Now, I'm writing that book, and at some point in time, hopefully the History Press or another publisher writes on it. But I was able to put that work into a chapter in that book.
Yeah, I certainly hope that becomes a book unto itself. The chapter on the communes and the hippies coming to Franklin County really was fascinating. That was one of my favorite in this book. Why was it, Jason, that this place attracted that counterculture, those back to the landers?
Well, it's a great question, and I think if anybody were to talk to their grandmother or grandfather, or if they have memories of that time period, the answers for why they would come to Franklin County, Vermont, or why they would come to Vermont are pretty varied. I think they grew up in a time period where the civil rights movement was underway, but sort of the promise of equality under the law was something that a lot of young people, they could look at images from the South in particular and wonder what was going on. And then the draft. I think there was definitely a certain sense of not wanting to be involved in that conflict in Southeast Asia in Vietnam. So you get to a point where a lot of these kids are leaving high school, a lot of these kids are in college, and you know, I can remember back to that time period and having thoughts about conquering the world and doing everything, you know, that I want to accomplish. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of those people just got to the point where they said, kind of to hell with what's happening in society. We're going to go off into the woods, and Vermont happened to be a very attractive place. So some of those people, you know, they probably weren't off into the woods. They were probably in, you know, they're down the street from somebody in a second home. But a lot of them did end up here in the communes. And the one up here in Franklin, they made a very specific effort to, I don't say reach out to a lot of locals, but they definitely became friends with locals.
Mm-hmm.
They learned from local grandmothers and local grandfathers about how to can vegetables, how to grow vegetables in the garden, how to take care of animals in the farm on the farm. So it was an effort for them to just, you know, I think for them it was a level of security, and it's something that they wanted to do. And if they relied on some of us locals to do that, then that's something that I try to explain in the book.
And they got a lot of help, a lot of direction from locals. But my favorite, one of my favorite stories in the book is how they were told to go about sugaring.
Yeah. So they purchased the commune, I believe it's February 4th of 1970, and they're moving in shortly afterward. The property that they bought in Franklin was huge. It has two beautiful sugar woods. And the group that originally bought the property, they were probably very interested in trying their hands at this from the start. So I think they had 2,000 or 3,000 sap buckets.
Mm-hmm.
They washed all of them by hands. And the story that's specifically in the book was there was a local who was very friendly and very helpful with them. But in the process of identifying all of the maple trees, said, go ahead and tap everything that's in sight. And one of the things that happened to be in sight was a telephone pole, and the youngsters ended up tapping that pole, and it ended up being a source of humor for locals for a little while longer. But you know, I think the folks on the commune, they kind of took it as a little bit of a badge of honor, because they had a relationship with that particular local, and they didn't feel like they had been taken advantage of.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they had just spent weeks in the sugar woods, so I think they were able to laugh about it as well.
We have about 2 minutes to the break, Jason, but one thing I also enjoyed in that chapter was learning that Ravi Shankar was here in Franklin County at that time.
Yes. So that was something that I was blown away by,
mm-hmm.
Particularly by the fact that you and I live in a world where, you know, you can send me an email and I can respond very quickly. They didn't have that technology. in the late 60s and early 70s, there was basically a network where artists and others were able to know where different events were happening. And in Vermont, the commune movement, or the back to the land movement, was a set thing. So in my research, I haven't been able to find which members of the Franklin Commune were able to arrange that, and I don't even know if they did. I'm imagining there could be a scenario where he just knew that there were communes in Vermont and wanted to stop by. Mm-hmm. But his particular visit was, there was a little bit of a gathering that they had. I think the quote in the book is that he played on the back porch one night to the campfire, while people were out, in front of the old farmhouse. Yeah. So mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a great story.
How long did that commune era last here in Franklin County?
Well, there are some sort of back-to-the-land elements or artistic elements which last well into the late 70s or early 80s. I know there's one person that I reference in the book. Her real name is not Mita Strick, but that's what she goes by today. Mm-hmm. She still lives on her property that was sort of just a place to live in the 1960s and 70s. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she's been great with her information and has let me interview her a couple times. But yeah, I think even though the commune movement or the back of the land movement is a specific era, I think a lot of those people are still around.
Wow. We're going to take a break and then return to learn more about Franklin County's hidden history from author Jason Barney. Listeners, if you'd like to get in the queue, ask a question, or share some Franklin history of your own, you can give us a call at 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. And coming up today at 11, we have Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. While visiting some of the eastern townships of Quebec with a friend a few years ago, I returned coming back through Franklin County. She was amazed at the beauty of the area and to learn that there was a village called St. Rocks, my favorite Vermont place name. Yes, even better than Goose Green. And our own Kaya Winchell Neely rode up through Franklin County recently and had the same reaction. Just a beautiful place. Well, this morning, we're giving Franklin County a lot of love, and this hour, we're discovering a lot about its history. Jason Barney's new book is Hidden History of Franklin County, Vermont, and he's with us until 11 to reveal some of it for us. Listeners, if you've got a question about Franklin County's history, you can give us a call, 244-1777-8 877-291-8255 is the toll-free number. Jason, let's talk about Franklin County's role in the Revolutionary War.
Okay. Well, hopefully we can squeeze this into the half hour that we have left. Part of this research is based on the fact that the 250th anniversary of the Revolutionary War is coming up here in just a couple of years. And Vermont does have some very large Revolutionary War era sites. One is the Ethan Allen Homestead in Chittenden County. And then down in Addison County, you've got Mount Independence, the area across from Fort Ticonderoga. Yep. That was a huge location. And then you also have the Battle of Hubbardton, and mm-hmm. down in Rutland counties, you've got some other smaller forts. So all of that is connected to what I do with my students and what research that I've been working on, in that in 1775, when Ethan Allen and Benedict Arnold get together and take Fort Ticonderoga, something that is not so well studied or maybe known in history is they immediately take control of some of the larger boats that are on Lake Champlain, some of the larger sailing vessels. And Benedict Arnold in particular, he has it in this idea that controlling Fort Ticonderoga is one thing, but it really doesn't matter unless the revolutionaries control Lake Champlain. Mm-hmm. So they take one boat down in Skenesboro, and then they sail up to my neck of the woods up here by Grand Isle County and Franklin County, and they go all the way up into Quebec, and they steal another boat. The two boats that end up being the first two boats of the American Navy are called the Liberty and the Enterprise. And this is actually the subject of the next book that I'm working on. It's Northern Vermont and the American Revolution. And this is intense research because I'm going through primary source documents of military reports that were written at the time and letters that were written at the time and visiting sites. And you just come to learn that in the fall of 1775, an entire American colonial army sailed north on Lake Champlain. They spent at least a night, maybe two or three nights, in Isle Lamont or on Isle Lamont. And at the time that all of that is happening, in Swanton, Vermont, there is a guy by the name of Simon Metcalf who owns a sawmill. And Metcalf and some of the other businessmen at the time are, you really never know what their loyalties are.
Right.
There are times, there's times when they're selling lumber and other things to the American cause. That American invasion of Quebec gets defeated in 1776. The colonial army retreats back down Lake Champlain to Fort Ticonderoga. And in the process, they want to deny use of anything that would be valuable to the British army. So I don't have the exact date yet, and I don't have the exact primary source material yet, but the sawmill that was right here in Swanton in the center of town gets burned. And I think it was the Americans who did it, trying to deny the British anything of value. Mm. So there's other sort of side veins of research where there's the Haley Basin Military Road that comes all the way up to Montgomery. I'm doing some research on that right now. Mm-hmm. And even before that, there were squads and companies of American soldiers that marched through Swanton and eastern Franklin County on their way up to Quebec. So it's a pretty unique vein of research. As somebody who's lived here my entire life, I'm surprised that somebody else hasn't gone into this level and wanted to tell the story.
Well, Jason, one thing that's really interesting as you're reading those chapters in your book is because of that proximity to the border, like you mentioned with Metcalf, the kind of shifting sands of, you know, sympathizers. There's, you know, those who are revolutionary sympathizers. Then there's the Tories or the British sympathizers who live there. It kind of, because it's so close to the Canadian border, seemed to shift back and forth through late 1700s, early 1800s.
Yeah, and Metcalf in particular, there's some evidence that he sold to the Americans as they moved north into Quebec mm-hmm. to support the invasion. But then when the invasion fails, the British are in his neck of the woods. And if Metcalf isn't specifically working with them, they're cutting some of the trees that are up here around Missisquoi Bay, and Metcalf has to deal with them. But that sort of thing happens after the war as well, mm-hmm. and that's covered in, I think, the second chapter or third chapter of my book, Hidden History. The situation that unfolded after the American Revolution, a lot of the Tories, mm-hmm. people who had supported the crown, they either got kicked out or they didn't want to live in what was about to be the United States. So they decided to go to a place where England still ruled, and the closest place was Quebec. Well, the border wasn't particularly well defined at that point in time, and a lot of them settled in the area of North Alberg. Some of them did settle here in Swanton, and there's some indication that some of them, yeah, they settled on the Missisquoi Canadian side of Quebec, but they were also in Highgate near Rock River and in Franklin. So that's a very neat, specific vein of research, which I'm still, for the third book, I'm still working on.
I can't wait to read more. That was really interesting. Civil War also had several impacts on Franklin County. Well, let's first talk about the young men who left the area to fight for the Union.
Yeah. So this is relevant today, and I don't want to get too political, but I know there are a lot of debates about what monuments are appropriate to be up or whether or not somebody has the right to fly the Confederate flag. But as a teacher, as a historian, I was fascinated to learn that probably the one battle that even people who don't know anything about the Civil War could tell you about is the Battle of Gettysburg. They had probably just heard some of the history around that battle.
Right.
Well, as it turns out, Vermont soldiers were at the Battle of Gettysburg. And there's a very good film, Gettysburg, where the one of the main units is highlighted on the second day of the battle. But on the third day of the battle, the Vermonters, and in particular men from Franklin County, are across the wheat field from the Southern soldiers as they're charging to get to the Union lines. And in particular, it's men from Bakersfield, it's men from Highgate, it's some men from St. Albans and Swanton. They are in a group of companies which blunt Pickett's Charge. Some of your listeners may be familiar with Pickett's Charge. And literally, you can't imagine a scenario where small-town Vermont or small-town USA would have a larger impact on the flow of events of history. You know, truth be told, Pickett's Charge was probably bound to fail anyway, but it's still a historical neat fact that the ancestors of the town that I live in were at that critical moment in the battle. So after the Battle of Gettysburg, there's something that is very well known up here called the St. Albans Raid.
Yes.
And that's an instance where Canadian raiders come down from Quebec. Those raiders happen to be not Canadian at all. They're actually ex-Confederate prisoners of war who had escaped to Quebec. They robbed the banks in St. Albans, but that act ended up being something which the Union military in Vermont, they basically mobilized to protect St. Albans and to protect elements of the frontier. So you've got Union soldiers that are stationed on the bridges in Highgate and Sheldon and Richford going over the Missisquoi River. And researchers at the time, through interviews, determined that the plot to rob the banks in St. Albans was actually a little bit more. They wanted to burn the town down, and they weren't able to burn St. Albans down because the concoction, the liquid fire that they had used was probably mixed wrong, and it was a fairly damp day. One other really neat historical part of that is right here in the center of Swanton by the Missisquoi River, there's an old building, brick building, that I think different businesses have been in on and off for long periods of time. But that building was a bank back in the 1800s, 1860s. And there's some evidence that the rebel raiders actually wanted to raid that bank in Swanton as well. As they retreated, they did stop by a bank in Sheldon, but there was a little bit of a, I don't want to say an altercation, but there was a circumstance where they didn't get in, and then they proceeded north up through Franklin and Berkshire, back over the Canadian border.
It's fascinating history. Jason, we heard from Stephen Middlebury, and he wants to know where he can buy your book. In Middlebury, do you know if is it Vermont Bookstore? Would they have it, or where do you go online?
Yeah, so I think if anybody went to their local bookstore, they could probably, if it's not directly on the shelves, because the History Press is a small regional press, and the book is about Franklin County history. So I know it's available at Barnes & Noble in Chittenden County, but you could also go to Amazon.
All right.
It's available on Amazon. Or you could go to the History Press's website, Acadia Publishing, and they have copies of it online as well.
All right. Steve, if you don't find it, let me know. Get in contact with me, and we'll find a place for you to get one of those. We only have a few more minutes. I want to cover a few more exciting chapters, and one that I think is so poignant right now is the chapter on the Spanish flu because of the COVID pandemic. How did the Spanish flu pandemic affect Franklin County?
Yeah, so this was a very serious chapter to cover. I did rely on newspapers.com quite a bit to sort of to track this because I wanted the facts and I wanted to be able to basically find out what had happened, particularly where, you know, we're receiving news about this pandemic really on a daily or hourly basis. So the virus spread in late 1917, 1918. When it gets, or the spring of 18, when it gets to Franklin County, it's basically the rail system at the time, because that would have been the major source of transportation or method of transportation for a lot of people. And you can kind of track or trace just how it was in southern Vermont first and then Burlington and St. Albans. By the time it hit up here in St. Albans, I think it's late September and October of 1918, the St. Albans Messenger had reported that there were well over 500 cases in the first 2 weeks.
Wow.
So the doctors at the time were basically in a situation where, you know, something that we've been worried about with COVID all along has been so many of us would get sick at a particular time in a particular region that the healthcare system would be overwhelmed. Well, that's kind of what happened with the Spanish flu. So with so many people getting sick, there were orders to close some of the pool halls. There were specific instances in the paper where public health officials were urging people not to spit in public. The schools were closed down temporarily. The early movie theaters at the time were closed down. Churches were asked to suspend operations for a little while. So a lot of the stuff that we're going through today did happen on another level. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in a sense, the Spanish flu, you know, 520-some-odd cases in 2 weeks in Franklin County, you know, I don't think COVID got anywhere near that when it was at its peak up here. So
right.
It's just an interesting balance to measure against historically.
Another, I'll mention there's chapters on the flood of 1927. The poor farms was really interesting. Old movie theaters and drive-ins in Franklin County. But I've got to give a nod to a couple others that I really love. The chapter on Prohibition is really kind of fun and interesting, the rum running that goes on.
Yeah, so Prohibition, living up here in Franklin County, we're on the Canadian border, and this was a treat to research.
Yeah.
Basically, you know, you have to look at the economics, and you have to ask yourself, well, if I could make enough money doing something, and it was against the law, would I do it? And the answer for the area of 1919 and into the 1920s for a lot of people up here in Franklin County was, yeah, they would do it. So alcohol is still legal in Canada, and the border is open. I mean, any discussion about a wall, there's still really no wall up here on the border with Canada. And there was a bunch of old dirt roads which weren't monitored. So in 1920, there's instances of people driving across the border and maybe trying to conceal a keg or bottles of liquor. But as the 1920s move on and Prohibition gets a little deeper into the culture and the government is trying to stop alcohol from entering the country, you start to have cars that are purchased by wealthy individuals, effectively redesigned so that there's a lot of hidden compartments. And the rum running is so prevalent that some of these characters who were being paid by wealthy interests, they were making not like one trip a day that they could have been going across the border as often as possible because there was money to be made.
Yeah.
And there are instances in the newspaper where these locals are getting nabbed, but you have to ask just how much alcohol was getting through the border. And the answer is quite a bit.
Yeah. Okay, one more chapter we're going to squeeze in, and I love this, is the Cold War chapter and some of the things that popped up in Franklin County because of it.
Yeah. So one of the first things I wanted to research, because the topic of the Cold War is so big, was some of the armories that populate a lot of our small towns. I know Swanton has one. And from what I was able to research, really the only one that sort of popped up in this neck of the woods because of the Cold War was the armory in St. Albans that was built right after World War II. Mm-hmm. But then when you get into the late 1950s and nuclear weapons are a real item, there was a ring of bases that was constructed around Plattsburgh Air Force Base. And those bases weren't, you know, typical military bases. They were missile silos. Most of them are in upstate New York. Two of them were constructed in Vermont. One's in Alberic, very close to the Canadian border. And then one was located right here in Swanton, not very far from the Missisquoi River. It's about 8 or 9 stories deep. They had to build effectively a massive sump pump because the area next to the missile location was basically it's next to the Missisquoi River and it's fairly close to Lake Champlain. Well, they had to dig down 9 stories, so a sump pump had to be part of that construction effort. The missile or the missiles are in the bases in Alberic and Swanton through the Cuban Missile Crisis, and there were locals, and this was a treat for me to research. My uncle, Armin Messier, was apparently one of the individuals who was stationed at the missile base.
Mm. And then the big golf ball that we see off of I-89 is a leftover relic of that Cold War as well.
Yeah, so this is also, as a teacher and teaching the local history class, this is something that is really neat that I can refer to my students.
Yeah.
Because we drive on the interstate all the time, and it's something that is visible. There's something that it's big and white, and it's a ball, so locals have identified it as the big golf ball. It's up on Fairfield Hill. That was part of a radar tower network that was established throughout the Northeast, where they wanted to be able to detect Russian fighters or missiles coming in over Canada. And if you look through the old photographs, there's not just one of those big radar towers up there or big golf balls. There's actually 5 or 6 of them. And there was an entire basically radar base that was built on top of Fairfield Hill.
Oh, my. Yeah, that's just one of the chapters in the book that's out now. It is called Hidden History of Franklin County, Vermont. And mention again, Jason, what you're working on, the next book that you have coming out.
So this summer I spent a lot of time working with the Vermont Archaeological Society, working with teachers and specifically on exposing some of Vermont's Revolutionary War sites. So my next book, to sort of take advantage of that research, I made the pitch for Northern Vermont and the Revolutionary War. So right now I'm knee-deep in research as to what was happening from 1775 to 1783 up here in my neck of the woods. And it just like the War of 1812 book that I wrote and just like the Hidden History, it's just a treat to really jump in and to try to connect the dots to events that people could read about in a history book or even see in a documentary. So it's pretty in-depth, and it'll be released, I think, in May of 2022.
All right. I hope you'll be back to talk about that with us, Jason. Jason Barney is an author and historian and teaches at Missisquoi Valley Union High School. The book is Hidden History of Franklin County, Vermont, published by the History Press. Jason, thanks so much. It's been really interesting this morning.
I appreciate you having me.
All right. Take care.
Good day.
Good day. All right. That's our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint, directed today by Lee Cattell. It's produced by Rachel Connor, Zoe Helena, and Brady Jalili. Our email address is vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. You can feel free to suggest topics or guests, and you can listen to past episodes of Vermont Viewpoint by downloading our podcast at wdevradio.com. Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayers up next. I'm Rick Sengary. I'll meet you back here tomorrow.